As always, we'll begin the meditation by listening to the sound of a bell ring 3 times. The bell is intended to set aside the meditation time as something special, something sacred, and it's meant to give you the doorway there. By focusing your attention completely on the sound of the bell, you're bringing your attention in line with the present moment. Because the doorway to the present moment always lies in our senses. Our thoughts take us away from it. We interpret, we analyze, we judge things as good or bad, but it's all just thoughts. And we've set aside these few minutes to practice not entertaining thoughts. So when we start out this meditation, we're focused on the experience of listening to the bell. And then we move on to the practice of following the breath. And for the next few minutes that you've set aside, your only job is to focus on your experience of breathing and not get caught up in thoughts. Thoughts about the breath, thoughts about the meditation, thoughts about grocery shopping, whatever your mind finds to fill the gaps. It's all the same. It's all just thoughts. And you're just practicing, observing those thoughts, letting them come and go, and not letting yourself get too caught up in them. But it's hard. It's really, really hard. Just try to stay focused on the present moment for the few minutes you set aside to practice, and you'll see just how hard it really is to do. You'll see how quickly your mind can work to fill in any spaces that you make. Just see how long you can sit in the space between your thoughts. It's humbling. But thankfully, mindfulness practice is all about the process and not about the outcome. It's not about not having thoughts. It's about learning how to recognize them and respond to them instead of automatically reacting to them. It's about learning how to observe your thoughts as they come and go without having to do anything with them or about them. Because your mind will inevitably distract you, pulling you away with thoughts of some kind. And the content doesn't really matter. It could be, "This is great." It could be, "I wish I hadn't had that for lunch." Or it could be, "This whole thing is silly." It doesn't matter what thoughts come up. What matters is what you do when you find yourself distracted. What matters is practicing, redirecting your attention back to the present moment. Again and again. It's mindfulness practice, not mindfulness perfection. Every time you find yourself off track, it's just another opportunity for growth, an opportunity for change. It really is just about the practice. So follow the sound of the bell, then follow the experience of the breath. I'll guide you along the way. Taking a few nice, deep, grounding breaths. Bringing your attention to the experience of the breath in the present moment. Just noticing how it feels to be breathing. Noticing the air as it flows through your nose and mouth. Notice the feeling of your chest and belly rising and falling with each breath. And as your mind drifts to chasing after thoughts, just notice it as soon as you can. Let it go. It's just a thought. Let it float away like a leaf on a stream. If the thought's that important, it'll come back to you. But now's the time to practice not engaging in thoughts. So as soon as you notice you're adrift, let it go. Take a deep breath and come back to your experience of breathing in the present moment. Following the in-breath all the way to the end. Following the out-breath all the way to the end. One breath at a time. One moment at a time. Noting any tendency you may have to want to jump ahead and assume what each breath will bring. Right now we're practicing, setting aside our assumptions, and just paying attention to the present moment. Anything else is just another thought taking you away from your direct experience. Just staying with the experience as long as you can. And when you're distracted, just notice it and come on back to your experience of the breath. Again and again. As the air starts to clear, and the dust starts to settle, you can find rest. You can find stillness. And you can find the clarity you need to grow. Because in this stillness, you can find wisdom and depth. Because it doesn't end here. I once heard Jon Kabat-Zinn say that you should practice like your life depends on it. And you know there's good reason to. Implicit in every moment is the fact of choice. You always have a choice. Even if you can't change much about what's happening to you, you can always change how you respond. You can always learn to better respond to whatever the world brings you. Responding with awareness, responding with wisdom, and responding with grace. You see, I teach mindfulness practice as a means to an end. It's the tool you use in the most important process you can participate in, the process of living a meaningful life, the process of living a good life. By whatever definition is most true to you. It's about getting clarity about what matters most deeply to you, right here and right now, and living a life more fully honoring that. It's about living a life of intention. Mindfulness practice is what helps you find clarity in stillness, so you can hear what deeply matters to you. Mindfulness practice helps you cultivate that stillness so that you can hear your intuitive voice. I've heard it said that your goal in life should be to find what it is that makes you feel most alive and to do it, because what the world needs now is more people to come alive. This is a quote by Howard Thurman from many years ago, but it seems to me more relevant today than ever before. While technology gives us access to the most incredible tools we have ever known, it can't help us to feel more alive. And sometimes I fear it pulls us in the other direction. We have access today to so much knowledge, so many streams of information. Sometimes it's really hard to hear our own voices in the midst of it all. And I fear with more breadth of information, we risk sacrificing depth of information. How deeply do we really process the things we come across these days? Think about how we find answers to our questions nowadays. If you have a smartphone, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you have access to the largest library in the world. In your pocket. It wasn't so long ago that research had to be done in brick-and-mortar libraries, looking through old encyclopedias that were outdated the day they were printed. And now, things are so different. I remember a therapist and teacher I used to work with. He was one of those teachers who everyone looked up to, everyone respected. He really seemed to be a wise man. I remember when he got his first smartphone and he was sitting in the common meeting area at our clinic. He was talking to a colleague about something. And in the course of their conversation, some question came up. Some piece of trivia that neither one knew at that moment, but both were curious about. I remember this man's face lighting up when he realized he had the answer in his pocket. He laughed and he pulled out the phone and he jokingly referred to it as God. As God. And it gave me pause. He compared it to God because it had access to so much information. It knows everything. Yes, knowledge is power, but knowledge and wisdom are not the same thing. We have access to so much information. How can we cut through all of it to find our own intuitive voices? How can we sort through it to know what we need? This is why I teach mindfulness practice. It's the best tool I've found to cut through the chatter, to cut through the distractions, to help you get clarity about what really matters to you. Technology has enormous power, and with enormous power always comes danger, risk of misuse, the need for responsible use, the risk of regret. You can gather all the facts in the world and become an expert on any subject and not hold any wisdom. The wisdom comes from depth. These days, when you want to do some research, what do? Most people type in some search terms on Google, scan the headlines, summarize what they see, and they move on, without really reading any of the information in depth. We're satisfied with scanning the headlines, summarizing, and moving on to the next thing. We're interacting on a surface level. How many of our relationships happen exclusively on Facebook or email or chat? How many of our interactions can be reduced to clicking a like button and moving on? Yes, technology can be an amazing tool. It holds unparalleled power. But power is seductive, no matter how you slice it. You might be familiar with Stanley Milgram's experiments that he conducted during the 1950s. These are the ones where volunteers believed they were delivering electric shocks to people in another room. For those who are unfamiliar, the basic idea is the people who volunteered for the experiments were told that it was research about teaching techniques. They were told that they were going to be teaching somebody in another room who was really an actor. Whenever the actor gave a wrong answer, the volunteer was told to push a button. The volunteer was told that the button would deliver an electric shock to the volunteer in the other room, and that the intensity of the electric shock would be raised with each wrong answer. So the more they got wrong, the stronger they got shocked. If the volunteer started to express discomfort about delivering the shocks, they were simply told by a man in a white coat, "The experiment requires that you continue." And a lot of people did. More than half the people in the experiment took it so far that they delivered the maximum shock level, which involved hearing the screams of pain in the other room, disregarding their sense that what they were doing was wrong. And in spite of hearing the person in the other room complain of chest pains, they kept going. And in spite of the person finally just going silent, more than half of them kept going. I've seen videos of these experiments, and they're deeply disturbing because you see their discomfort and it comes out in grotesque ways like laughing and things like that. It's just horrifying. And when I first heard about this, and along with my classmates, was appropriately horrified, I was in a high school sociology class taught by a great guy named Mr. White. After he described these experiments where we saw normal people making horrible choices, everyone in the class reacted with comments like, "Oh, those were evil people. Oh, I wouldn't do such a thing." But in the next part of the lesson, he had us read diaries written by SS officers, showing the more normal, everyday side of Hitler's machine, the way it was supported in the everyday actions of everyday people, not necessarily consciously. And we're all capable of it if we're not careful. And I found that the conversations I had about Milgram's experiments shifted the more I learned about working with people. It went from a sense of those people who made those choices were different from me. I would never do such a thing. To not being so sure. Were all the German people who had the misfortune of growing up in Hitler's generation to blame for the horrors that happened there? To be sure, Hitler couldn't have done anything if he hadn't had people follow him. And while there were certainly some evil leaders, the bulk of the people making Hitler's machine go were ordinary people. Not so different from you and me. Inaction is still action. By choosing to ignore something and not respond is still your choice, and every action matters. You need to know your heart. You need to know your core values. You need to stay in touch with what is important to you. Don't let yourself let go of it, even when it's hard. That's when it's most important. Don't be a part of a crowd going terribly astray. And it's not all about the people holding the guns either. It's all on a continuum, and we're all capable of doing our parts for good or for evil. The everyday choices of everyday people have more power than all the leaders combined. As Gandhi said, be the change you wish to see in the world. It sounds so simple, but never underestimate your ability to get off track. Groupthink is powerful stuff. Of course, we can't replicate Stanley Milgram's experiment today. I mean, the process, it was really damaging to the people involved. Can you imagine living with the knowledge that you would willingly let yourself deliver those electric shocks? And the only reason you did it was because some guy in a white coat told you the experiment must continue? There's another more recent experiment where researchers recruited undergraduates for an experiment that they were told was about vision. A volunteer would walk into a room with something like 20 other people, but what the volunteer didn't know was that the rest of the people were all actors. One volunteer in a room full of actors. Everybody sat down facing a screen that had several lines on it. There was a top line and a group of different lengths of line below. The idea was that everybody needed to go around the room saying which line on the bottom matched the length of line at the top. The volunteer was seated so that they would give their answer last, after everyone else. At first, the volunteer found everybody unanimously making the same choices that he does. It's so simple, it almost seems silly. But then he hears everyone going before him saying B when he clearly sees the answer is A. What would you do? You see how somebody could get self-conscious. You see how tempting it might be to not look the fool and give an answer in line with everybody else's. Especially as a college freshman living away from home for the first time, feeling a bit like a fish out of water, hoping you'll fit in. Never underestimate your ability to get off track. Blind following, when left unchecked, can be so dangerous. And the risk is just as real for following your own routine trains of self-talk. We all get into ruts of our thinking. Runaway trains of thought that we're so used to, we just take for granted. And so many of these thoughts are unkind, lacking compassion. This happens, so we automatically assume this and conclude this. So A equals C, and we forget about B. B is our perspective, our unique filters, the glasses through which we look at the world. Those filters have an enormous impact on the way we interact with the world. Imagine this. You're walking down the street and you see someone you know walking past on the other side. You smile and you wave to them, but they don't wave back, and you swear they saw you. What do you make of that? Do you assume they must have not seen you, even though it looked like they did? Or do you assume that they did see you and they ignored you? What is the story you tell yourself about your experiences? And at what point do you take those assumptions for facts? The more we're on autopilot, the more we can get off track. And it takes awareness to know when that happens. And it takes stillness to find our way back. Like the glass of water filled with sand that we've talked about before. Mixed up and cloudy, it's hard to see through it, but put it up on a shelf, letting it be for just a bit. It creates clarity. The silt separates from the water and you can discern one from the other. You can't rush stillness, but it's still necessary to cultivate, because if you don't, you risk drifting off track. Know why you're making the choices that you do. Because every moment holds an opportunity for choice, whether or not you pay attention to it. Every action you take in this world is, in the end, your choice. And it becomes your legacy. So I intend to make my legacy one of reminding people to listen to themselves, to value themselves and their intuitive voices, to help people prune their lives so they can finally come alive and truly be the best person they can be. And so this program was born. Please share it. Please share it with anyone you think might benefit. And please give me feedback. I want to reach as many people as I can. But most of all, please practice. Please be the change that you wish to see in this world.